this chance. And God's loving me anyway. God's forgiven me anyway. And of course, what that gives you is an immense compassion for other people. Only when you know you have been forgiven, and this is just true, when you know you have been forgiven, you have the space, the grace to forgive other people, even for the damn stupid things they've done to you. So you disidentify from this viewing platform with your own emotional noise, your own narcissistic commentaries on everything, and you no longer let it pull you up and down. That's what it means to be awake. So you achieve a kind of equanimity. When things are wonderful, you don't overreact. Well, that's great, wonderful. When things are terrible, you don't fall into depression. I call that emotional sobriety. I think last year was my biggest selling CD. And the Resource Center kept telling me that. And I said, God, I say all these profound things about Paul and the Trinity. And they want us a CD on emotional sobriety. because I think we're realizing that's where most of us get trapped. That's what undoes us. These endless dramas of victimhood and aggressiveness and anger and attack that play themselves out in our mind. And, you know, I used to think just a few people were victims of obsessive compulsive disorder. But the more I observe the human mind, I think we all are. I think we all are. If you watch your thoughts, you think the same damn thought over and over and over and over again. You're all obsessive compulsive. So. And only when you create that viewing platform and observe that do you see it. Why am I thinking that again? No? Wasn't that resolved last year? And there's men in our men's work who can't get over things that happened 2 years ago. That's what happens to you when you live inside of what you can call the monkey mind. No? It's just repetitive, obsessive. It's hell after a while. It's just hell. Because for some reason, what we're attracted to, and this is demonic, is the negative. We wrap around the problem, and this is particularly true of men. No, women do it too, just in a different way. If there's a conspiracy theory, if there's some big evil happening, you know, in a woman, you want to be the first one to find it out, you know? And then you obsess over it, and it gets 10 times bigger than it ever deserved to be. But for some reason, there's a morose pleasure in doing that. Admit it. You know that's true. Whereas when something wonderful happens, now maybe sevens are an exception to this, but it is hard to wrap around happiness. It is. It is. When something really good happens, they say the joy in opening a package lasts for 2.5 minutes after opening the package. And then, well, the next package. Just watch kids at Christmas. You can't hold on to joy. But for some reason, you can hold on to pain. And there's a morose delight in doing it. So, and replaying it over and over again. This is hell. And a lot of our people are living in hell. Because if you've done that for years, by the time you're my age, and I know many of you have heard me say this, I checked it out with Dr. Oz to make sure it was true. That, and you doctors could say it better than I do, but the neural grooves that you prefer, the practice habitual responses, that you're always judgmental, you're always dismissive, you're always critical, all that negative stuff, though every time you go back to that same rot, the doctors say the neural groove myelinates. It's bigger and bigger. And when I was asking Dr. Oz about this, he says, Richard, it's worse than that. He says, not only do the grooves you practice using get stronger and stronger, But the ones you never practice die. You have to practice being a forgiving person. You do. It doesn't come naturally. You have to practice it in someone who doesn't deserve forgiveness, and you do it anyway, huh? And that little neural groove starts growing right here. I don't know where it is. And every time you do it, it becomes easier, you know? And as I've said in many groups, you know, I think most people my age have 4 neural grooves left. Old people are boring. Let's just be honest. They're so boring. Absolutely predictable responses. You know what she's going to say. You know what he's going to say. And you're going to become that if you don't watch it. Bored and boring. Because you've only got 4 neural grooves left, right? Resentment, judgment, criticism, and sarcasm, you know? Because that's what you practice for 45 years. It becomes impractical. And that's why I talk about rewiring. You've got to that's what contemplation does. You stand on your observing platform, you see yourself doing it again, and you practice not doing it. I'm not going to go. Where does it say in the Bible? The dog returns to its vomit. I'm not going to return to my vomit, all right? And you learn little by little to recognize what is moving toward death, what is moving toward negativity, fear, resentment. As I told you, I just came back from this Pauline tour, and after Athens and Delphi, Ephesus, I think my favorite place was Philippi, where they still have what they're quite sure, some of you have been there, I'm sure, the jail cell, the prison cell, where Paul was chained, literally. And right next to it were the jailers. Remember the jailers? There's an earthquake, and Paul is loosened from his chains. And next door, the little jailers are going to commit suicide, because they're sure they've run away. But Paul yells, "We're actually over here, guys. It's okay. You're not going to lose your heads." You can still see that. Well, they would have been the first conversions in what is now Europe. Philippi is just right across the Bosphorus from Asia. And anyway, in reading his whole letter to the Philippians, I am convinced now, and I'd like to make a CD on this. it's an entire teaching on mind control and the power of positive thinking. This guy has been chained there. And he writes this when he's in chains again in Rome. And you can just see he's doing everything to not let that destroy him. But read Philippians in that light. And he says, "Brothers, just think of everything that is noble, that is good, that is worthy of praise." He's teaching the power of positive thinking. The Norman Vincent Peale thought he discovered that, you know? It's already in Paul. You can't survive without it. By the time you're my age, you have been betrayed, rejected, talked about, abandoned, lost money, lost jobs. How many times? And each one of those just stays there as a scab. And if you don't know what to do with it, if you don't know some place to hand that over, it will control your life in the second half of life. That's most people I know. I'm just being honest. It's most people I know. Are not very free, are not very happy by the second half of life. So I stop thinking about this or that, and I collapse into pure consciousness of nothing in particular. You don't get there, you fall there. It's not a climbing. It's an unlearning. It's a letting go. It's a surrendering. It's a detaching, not an attaching. Now, who's going to teach you detachment in a capitalist culture? Nobody. Even most churches know nothing about detachment. So that's why I got to emphasize it. If you don't get it here, I don't know where you're going to get it. Because it's something that's almost a cultural loss. As religion became itself more and more identified with the powers and the systems that supported it. Let me sum this up in a small book I don't know if any of you read it, called The Four Agreements by Don Miguel Ruiz.
Hear, hear.
He was raised in a simple little Mexican village. I don't think he ever identified as a Christian. He identified much more with his Toltec Native American roots and tradition. Whether what he says here is entirely true, I don't even say I agree with all of it. But there's enough wisdom here, it goes a long way. And I just want to share with you as a way of summing up what I was trying to say, what he calls the four agreements. He says we've all made agreements with ourselves, with other people, with our dream of life, with God, with society, with your parents. But the most important agreements are the ones you've made with yourself. And he says that his Toltec Mexican tradition, his shamans and elders, and I think his mother was a curandera, his father was a shaman. He says he learned this from them. And if you're expecting me to say something really wild and off the wall, I'm not going to. It's these four things that are so simple. So simple that we all assume we do them, or that we assume we know how to do them. And I want to say, after supposedly founding the community in Cincinnati and the CAC and now the Living School and Lumen, it's not doing this work down in the basement that has undone so many of our projects and so many of our people. That the negative, the gossip, the lie, the game just overtakes them because they don't know how to clear house here, you know? They don't know how to clarify what they're feeling and why they're thinking and why am I attracted to conspiracy theories, you know? I bet I could start one little conspiracy. Richard's having an affair. And all of you would know it within 10 minutes. So anything that's, oh yeah, God, we love it, you know? You'd all know before the night was out, you know? Jim Heaney, who's done so much good work with us, especially in Southern California, he's a successful businessman. And he told me years ago, he says, there's only one thing in my business that I absolutely insist on. And it's one reason he says, I think my company survives. He says, we have zero tolerance for gossip. Zero. Zero. And he says, you're told that the first day you're hired. If you ever tell any stories about any other person and it comes to my attention, you are immediately fired. Do you understand that? No. He said, you can't believe a rule for clearing the house right at the bottom. Because this has undone so much of our work. So much of the work of the church, of the gospel, of people who love to attach to the negative, huh? And then feed it and fill it in and fill in the gaps. So, here are the four agreements which I just offered you. And I think you'll see how they undercut all of these mind games. The first one, be impeccable with your word. Speak with integrity. Say just what you mean. Not embroidering the truth to get what you want. Not overstating your case. I'm going to give a very crass example, but over the years, because we've given a lot of big conferences, we'll invariably have people who, say, to, I guess, show they have a legitimate complaint or something. I wrote three times and none of your staff answered me, you know? What kind of organization is this? Invariably, when we check it out, and we can check who the email came from, it's usually one time, you know? But they'll always have to exaggerate the truth to make their case. How you do anything is how you do everything. This idea of, you know, really honoring your own dignity enough to speak truth. And and not to exaggerate the truth to get what you want. This is just the way the ego works. It makes up stories and creates storylines to be able to feel offended and be able to gain rights. Ruiz says, avoid using the word to speak against yourself, too, and to gossip about others. Use the power of your word always in the direction of truth and in the direction of love. He used to say, before you say anything, make sure what you're going to say can pass through three gates. This doesn't mean that it's always sweet. You sometimes have to say hard things. The first gate is it true? And that's what he's talking about. Obviously, don't say things that aren't true. If we just do that, can you imagine what a different world it would be? What a different politics we would have. The second gate is it loving? And again, I don't mean by that it's a sweet, but is it going to build up life in the long run? Am I really caring about that person and not just myself? But the third gate is sometimes the most difficult of all. Is it necessary? We're a culture filled with useless, meaningless chatter about things that don't matter. Nervous chatter, we call it. What you respect and you see it more in old people is they don't speak so much. When they do speak, it's worth listening to. Brothers, that's what I want you to aim for. That when you say something, the other brothers in the circle will take up a notice. Because they know you don't just talk to be talking. Verbal diarrhea, we used to call it. Now, when you say it, it means something. When I first came into Mexico, I worked with the Acoma Indians west of Albuquerque. That's when I fell in love with this state. And I remember being able to go to some of the in-house meetings of the community. And invariably, the old men and the old women would not speak for almost the whole meeting. It was all the young hotshots doing all the talking, you know? And then at the very end, usually the last 10 minutes, the old men and the old women would talk. And it meant more than all of the previous 3 hours. The second agreement that you have to make with yourself, don't, and I already said it actually, don't take things personally. That's the sign of a narcissistic personality. Remember that song, You're So Vain? You probably think this song is about you. I think a lot of us are. We think it's all about us, this song. Nothing others do really is about you. Can you believe that? It's always about them. Oh, it takes you so long to realize that, you know? It's always about them. Like, even people thank me and praise me a lot, and I really, I've said it to some of you here, you know, I'd say a lot more about you than it is about me. That whatever I've tried to say has meant that much to you. It means you've got an open heart, you've got an open mind, you've got an open spirit. It's saying loads about you. That whatever I've said has been so meaningful to you. So, Ken Keyes said years ago, much more suffering comes into the world by people taking offense than by people giving offense. I think that's true. People love to be offended. You see, when you can prove, we call it political correctness now, when you can take offense, you know what you just achieved? Moral high. Yeah, and that's what some people want. Atheists love that. They love moral high ground. So they'll take offense at this and that and everything. Well, we all do it. But they're just masters of it. You know? Always there's something terrible that they have to correct and improve. And they're on the moral high ground and the rest of us are just stupid idiots. But we all play that game. They're taking things personally, taking offense. My job is to move in and make it right. Brothers, the only reason I can talk about things like this is because I've done it. When you are immune to the opinions and actions of others, you won't be the victim of needless suffering. Now, you know, what she's saying, it did hurt a little bit, but you really do let it roll off your back after a while. It's all about her, and this is her problem, this is her issue. I was talking to an old Cistercian brother last month, and he said, it's taken me most of my life to realize that almost nothing is any of my business. Almost nothing is any of my business. And I thought women were bad with that kind of stuff, but I found in men's work, men can be just as bad, making all kind of things their business that are none of their business. And especially if there's a tinge of scandal to it, or conspiracy theory, or something that's terrible, and it's their job to expose it, you know, then they get their high horse. But it's all taking the whole agenda far too serious. Third, a grievance. Don't make assumptions. If you can, whenever you're confused, brothers, clarify your assumption. Oh, it's kept me from so much misunderstanding. Is that what you meant? Don't assume that's what they meant. Is that what you intended to do? You married people must have to do this. How do you live together without constantly clarifying the assumption with your partner?
Oh.
But moving ahead with unclarified assumptions just sets you up for constant mistrust, antagonism, and ill will. Find the courage to ask questions and to express what you really want, and to find out what they really meant. It'll save you a lot of grief in the long run. Don Ruiz says, with just this one agreement, you can completely transform your life. I don't know if that's totally true, but I can see why he'd say it. Because people tend to make the assumptions that fit their storyline. You've already got your storyline of what you want to be. The Democrats are always wrong. All right. Okay, there's your storyline. It's half true and it's half not true. But what we get in is the assumptions that affirm what you've already decided to believe. Do you see, brothers, how this keeps us in perpetual ignorance? And why we have a country that is not producing wisdom people? That we have Congress, who are a lot of people with PhDs, and appear to be at such a low level of awareness, because they've never created a platform to look back at the agreements they've made, the assumptions they've made about life. And the fourth one probably just sounds like a self-help agreement, but he develops it very well. Always do your best. Doesn't that sound like a little Boy Scout motto? But when I read that and wanted to just throw it away as a meaningless line, I have to say to Richard, well, Richard, how often do you do that? I mean, you might think I do because I'm sitting up here looking important. But, you know, I'm just like you, and I take the easier path, and I cover my own ass, and try to look good, and don't always do my best. If you really lived that every day, what, Richard, is the best response you can give? How can you keep this heart clean, this mind clean, so you can enter into this situation with love and with presence? So I offer you this as some ways of unlearning. That's all. I admit it. Maybe to many of you it isn't very profound. You say, well, Richard didn't say much to me. But maybe when you think about it, you'd realize that these kind of simple agreements, these kind of simple understandings of what awareness means, what consciousness means, I think they are big enough to change your life.
Here, here. Thank you. Oh.